Chapter 10. Larry woke up with a hangover that was not too bad, a mouth that tasted as if a baby dragon had used it for a potty chair, and a feeling that he was somewhere he shouldn't be. The bed was a single, but there were two pillows on it. He could smell frying bacon. He sat up, looked out the windows at another gray New York day, and his first thought was that they had done something horrible to Berkeley overnight. Then last night began coming back, and he realized he was looking at Fordham, not Berkeley. He was in a second-floor flat on Tremont Avenue, not far from the concourse, and his mother was going to wonder where he had been last night. Had he called her, given her any kind of excuse, no matter how thin? He swung his legs out of bed and found a crumpled pack of Winston's with one crazy cigarette left in it. He lit it with a green plastic Bic lighter. It tasted like dead horse shit. Out in the kitchen, the sound of frying bacon went on and on, like radio static on the AM band. The girl's name was Maria, and she had said she was a oral hygienist or something. Larry didn't know how much she knew about hygiene, but she was great on oral. Maria had been a little overwhelmed to discover he was that Larry Underwood. At one point in the evening's festivities, hadn't they gone reeling around looking for an open record store so they could buy a copy of Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? He groaned very softly and tried to retrace yesterday from its innocuous beginnings to its frantic, gobbling finale. The Yanks weren't in town, he remembered that. His mother had been gone to work when he woke up, but she had left a Yankee schedule on the kitchen table along with a note. As you can see, the Yankees won't be in town until July 1st. They are playing a doubleheader the 4th of July. If you're not doing anything that day, why not take your mom to the ballpark? I'll buy the beer and hot dogs. There was a typical Alice Underwood P.S. Most of the kids you hung around with are gone now, and good riddance to that bunch of hoods, but I think Buddy Marks is working at that print shop on Stricker Avenue. Just thinking of that note was enough to make him wince. No dear before his name, no love before her signature. She didn't believe in phony stuff. The real stuff was in the refrigerator. Sometime while he had been sleeping off his long drive across country, she had gone out and stocked up on every goddamn thing in the world that he liked. Her memory was so perfect it was frightening. A daisy canned ham. 2 pounds of real butter. How the hell could she afford that on her salary? 2 six-packs of Coke. Deli sausages. A roast of beef already marinating in Alice's secret sauce. And a gallon of Baskin-Robbins chocolate cheesecake ice cream in the freezer. The oral hygienist came in, wearing a pink nylon half-slip and nothing else. "Hi, Larry," she said. She was short, pretty in a vague Sandra Dee sort of way, and her breasts pointed at him perkily without a sign of a sag. What was the old joke? She had a pair of 38s and a real gun. Ha-ha, very funny. He had come 3,000 miles to spend the night being eaten alive by Sandra Dee. "Hi," he said, and got up. He was naked, but his clothes were at the foot of the bed. He began to put them on. "I've got a robe you can wear if you want to. We're having kippers and bacon." Kippers and bacon? His stomach began to fold in on itself with horror. "No, honey, I've got to run. Someone I've got to see."
"Oh, hey, you can't just run out on me like that."
"Really, it's important."
"Well, I'm important, too."
She was starting to be strident, and that hurt Larry's head. "Your Bronx is showing, love," he said.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
She planted her hands on her hips, and her breasts jiggled fetchingly. But Larry wasn't fetched. He stepped into his pants and buttoned them.
"So I'm from the Bronx. Does that make me black? What have you got against the Bronx?"
"Nothing," he said, and walked over to her in his bare feet.
"Listen, the somebody I have to meet is my mother. I just got into town 2 days ago, and I didn't call her last night or anything, did I?" he added hopefully.
"You didn't call anybody," she said sullenly.
"I just bet it's your mother."
He walked back to the bed and stuck his feet in his loafers.
"It is, really. She works in the chemical bank building as floor supervisor." "I bet you aren't the Larry Underwood that has that record, either."
"You believe what you want. I have to run."
"You cheap prick," she flashed at him. "What am I supposed to do with all the stuff I cooked?"
"Throw it out the window."
She uttered a high squawk of anger and hurled the spatula at him. On any other day of his life, it would have missed him. One of the first laws of physics was, to wit, a spatula will not fly a straight trajectory if hurled by an angry oral hygienist. Only this was the exception that proved the rule. Flip-flop, up and over, smash, right into Larry's forehead. It didn't hurt much. Then he saw two drops of blood fall on the throw rug as he bent over to pick the spatula up. He advanced two steps with the spatula in his hand. "I ought to paddle you with this," he shouted at her.
"Sure," she said, cringing back and starting to cry. "Why not? Big star, fucking run. I thought you were a nice guy. You ain't no nice guy."
Several tears ran down her cheeks, dropped from her jaw, and plopped onto her upper chest. Fascinated, he watched one of them roll down the slope of her right breast and perch on the nipple. It had a magnifying effect. He could see pores and one black hair sprouting from the inner edge of the aureole. "Jesus Christ, I'm going crazy," he thought wonderingly.
"I have to go," he said. His white cloth jacket was on the foot of the bed. He picked it up and slung it over his shoulder.
"You ain't no nice guy," she cried at him as he went into the living room. "I only went with you because I thought you were a nice guy."
The sight of the living room made him groan inwardly. On the couch, where he dimly remembered being gobbled, were at least 24 copies of Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? 3 more were on the turntable of the dusty portable stereo. On the far wall was a huge poster of Ryan O'Neill and Ally McGraw. Being gobbled means never having to say you're sorry. Ha ha. Jesus, I am going crazy. She stood in the bedroom doorway, still crying, pathetic in her half-slip. He could see a nick on one of her shins where she had cut herself shaving.
"Listen, give me a call," she said. "I ain't mad."
He should have said, "Sure," and that would have been the end of it. Instead, he heard his mouth utter a crazy laugh, and then, "Your kippers are burning." Larry got out quickly and pounded down the stairs. As he went down the last 6 steps to the front door, he heard her in the upstairs hall yelling down,
"You ain't no nice guy. You ain't no..."
He slammed the door behind him, and misty, humid warmth washed over him, with it the smell of spring trees and automobile exhaust. It was perfume after the smell of frying grease and stale cigarette smoke. He still had the crazy cigarette, now burned down to the filter, and he threw it into the gutter and took a deep breath of the fresh air. Wonderful to be out of that craziness. Return with us not to those wonderful days of normalcy as we... Above and behind him, a window went up with a rattling bang, and he knew what was coming next.
"I hope you rot,"
she screamed down at him.
"I hope you fall in front of some fucking subway train. You ain't no singer. You're shitty in bed, you louse. Take this to your mother, you louse."
A milk bottle came zipping down from her second-floor bedroom window. Larry ducked. It went off in the gutter like a bomb, spraying the street with glass fragments. A scotch bottle came next, twirling end over end, to crash nearly at his feet. Whatever else she was, her aim was terrifying. He broke into a run, holding one arm over his head. This madness was never going to end. From behind him came a final, long, braying cry, triumphant with juicy Bronx intonation.
"Kiss my ass, you cheap bastard!"
Then he was around the corner and on the expressway overpass, leaning over, laughing with a shaky intensity that was nearly hysteria, watching the cars pass below. "Couldn't you have handled that better?" he said, totally unaware that he was speaking out loud. "Oh, man, you could have done better than that. That was a bad scene. Crap on that man." He realized he was speaking aloud, and another burst of laughter escaped him. He suddenly felt a dizzy, spinning nausea in his stomach and squeezed his eyes tightly closed. A memory circuit clicked open, and he heard Wayne Stuckey saying, "There's something in you that's like biting on tinfoil." He had treated the girl like an old whore on the morning after the frat house gangbang. "You ain't no nice guy." "I am, I am." But when the people at the big party had protested his decision to cut them off, he had threatened to call the police, and he had meant it. Most of them were strangers, true. He could care if they crapped on a landmine. But 4 or 5 of the protesters had gone back a ways. and Wayne Stuckey, that bastard, standing in the doorway with his arms folded like a judge or something. Sal Doria going out, saying, "If this is what it does to guys like you, Larry, I wish you were still playing sessions." He opened his eyes and turned away from the overpass, looking for a cab. Oh, sure. The outraged friend bit. If Sal was such a big friend, what was he doing there sucking the cream in the first place? I was stupid, and nobody likes to see a stupid guy wise up. That's the real story. You ain't no nice guy. I am a nice guy, he said sulkily. And whose business is it anyway? A cab was coming, and Larry flagged it. The chemical bank building on Park, he said, climbing in. You got a cut on your forehead, guy, the cabbie said. A girl threw a spatula at me, Larry said absently. The cabbie offered him a strange, false smile of commiseration and drove on, leaving Larry to settle back and try to imagine how he was going to explain his night out to his mother.